Double whammy.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have Redmond on the other line. We just have one other call we're making because we have a one of our people that usually attends has just been health-wise not able to come, but they want to keep listening. So we're just connecting with her.
And that was my call.
Yeah. Okay. You're on my cell phone. So in case you get off again, call on the cell phone.
You guys are going to run out of phones pretty soon.
Oh, fine.
I know.
It'll be a good problem.
We have a few extras.
Yeah,
we have extras.
Oh, yeah. We got mine and his Brenda's here. We have Larry's.
Yep. Daryl,
yep,
if we need
sure
one.
Is. Well, hang on a minute. Rick, we'll get you through here, okay?
Yeah, we've got about four or five more phones if we need them, so.
There we go.
Hi, Lil. How you doing, Lillian?
Oh, good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
How was the road by you?
We had a lot of flooding for the folks that are out of state here, down in this area. We had a lot of rain today. By me, they're okay, but if you go about two blocks past me, some of the roads are still closed over that way.
They showed Cobo Lake by the bridge there on Lake Avenue. The water is rushing like crazy. It's flowing over a tank.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Getting on that bridge overpass, just in awe of the whole mess.
I know. It's an impressive thing when you see what nature can do.
Yeah.
Water is very destructive.
It is. It is. So I'll just wait for...
Where did they go?
I'm not sure.
One went to the bathroom, I think.
It's okay. We'll go to Luke 21, which is where we were last week. And I'll just look at a few verses here and do a recap, and then we'll progress. So, Luke 21, and why don't we read verses, let's just go 6 through, 6 and 7, first 6 and 7 of Luke 21. As for these things that you are gazing at, the days will come when not one stone will be left on another, all will be torn down. Then they said to him, Teacher, when shall this happen? And by what sign shall we know that the event is coming? So, in Luke here, this would be Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse, and it would coincide with Mark chapter 13 and Matthew chapter 24 and 25. And it's interesting because in all three of those accounts, Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, they're going to ask pretty much the same question. Or, you know, it might be worded a little bit differently, but it's really the same gist with the question. And there's really actually two questions that are being asked. The first question is in relationship to the time of the destruction of the temple. Again, looking at verse 7 of Luke 21, then they said to him, that they here would be the four individuals he's speaking to. We know that it's four individuals from Mark 13:3. The individuals would be Peter, James, John, and Andrew, the two sets of brothers. Those four individuals, they ask Jesus in verse 7, when shall this happen in Luke's account? And in reference to the temple being torn down. Then the second part of the question, by what sign shall we know that the event is coming? Now, it's interesting because you're going to have a lot of deviation between what Luke says, although it'll read similar, there is differences, and the differences are really important to know. and what Matthew and Mark say. Matthew and Mark are going to focus their response, or Jesus' response, to the second question. And again, that second question, and as it's recorded by Luke, is, by what sign shall we know that the event is coming? And the event that he's talking about is the conclusion of the eon. So Matthew and Mark are really concerned with the conclusion of how this eon ends. And Matthew 24 and 25 and Mark chapter 13 are really going to focus on the events of the close of this eon. Luke, however, is more concerned, and most of his response is going to be in relationship to when the temple is going to be destroyed. And it's interesting because Luke gives an in-depth answer of the first question, and Matthew and Mark give an in-depth response to the second question. Now, last week we looked a little bit on how sometimes in Scripture you can have a prophecy that has a short-term fulfillment, and then later on he has something else that comes by, and it's like, wow, this was speaking of that prophecy, and it's a long-term fulfillment. Give an example of that. And this is one that people typically don't think of. But in the book of Isaiah, okay, you have the sign of a woman who's going to be born. Okay? A young woman. The King James will translate it as a virgin. Okay? But really the word is used of any young woman of marriageable age. Not necessarily a virgin. But in Isaiah chapter 7, you have this prophecy that's given. And it's interesting, in chapter number 8, I believe, you have the fulfillment of that prophecy. His wife gives birth to a child, and that child is referred to as a sign for Israel to know that the events that Isaiah had prophesied about would come true. That's the short-term fulfillment. But then that passage will be mentioned by Gabriel in relationship to Mary, and we see a long-term fulfillment where something in the past is that short-term thing that's foreshadowing something in the future. And you see a lot of prophecies that are like that in Scripture. And what you have is this whole idea that goes forth in it, where there's a short-term fulfillment. In Isaiah's case, a woman gives birth to a child. And it's of note because God had made a lot of prophecies in relationship to the birth of this child. It's the culmination of what God was looking at and how he was dealing with Judah during the time of Assyria. And he's giving that prophecy relating to what would happen and transpire, and this is how they would know it would take place. Then that same prophecy is used in relationship to the birth of Christ, and a greater child is born. And this child becomes the basis of a lot of greater promises to the nation of Israel. Yet there's somewhat the same promises that Israel would go through judgment and would persevere through the judgment and would still remain. So you have a short term and a long term. Another prophecy that is like that I think sometimes we don't think about is when God gives a prophecy to Abraham that he's going to have a seed. The immediate short-term fulfillment of that is Isaac. Yet, there's a long-term fulfillment according to Paul in Galatians chapter 2, and that long-term fulfillment is Christ himself. So short term, long term. A lot of scriptures will do that. A lot of prophecies will have that short term view, and then you get to the New Testament, and all of a sudden this prophecy pops back up again, and it's now being talked about being fulfilled. So short term, long term. And the reason I bring that up is Luke is going to be the presentation of the short-term fulfillment of what's being talked about here, and Matthew and Mark are looking at the long-term thing that's future. So from our vantage point, Luke has written about a lot of events that have already transpired. Matthew and Mark have written about events that are yet to occur. Yet, it's all part of the same dialogue. Now, it's funny that it's called the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus is only talking to four people here, too. But it is. So, you know, that's kind of where we were last week, and we looked at some of the things that had transpired.
The Sermon on the Mount.
The Olivet Discourses. Yeah, I'm sorry.
So is that why the devil's preterists, people think that so much of
the story? The preterists will really use Luke. Now, there's a verse in Matthew that they like where it talks about this generation. They like that verse, but then they'll get out of Matthew as fast as they can and go into Luke. Because Luke really is talking about the events that they want to talk about. He's talking about the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., And we looked at some detail about how Luke talks about that time frame. He even gets into some things that he ties in, like for instance in verse 12. He gets that verse 11, before I get to verse 12, verse 11 he talks about the great earthquakes, plural. And we saw from a historical point that there was a number of earthquakes that took place right before the invasion of Jerusalem. One of them actually took place on the day that Nero assumed the throne, right? Then we looked at the famines and how there were some of the famines that were dealt with in that time frame, in particular the biggest one being during the reign of Claudius. That there were four different famines that were recorded. So, you had that famines bring pestilence. It just is an offshoot of famines. So you had all those things. Then you had the idea of being persecuted and surrendered, right, into the synagogues and the prisons. And we looked at some of the early Acts accounts on how the apostles had been arrested and actually had to go on defense, and how they didn't take any thought to what they would say, but the Spirit filled them and gave them the words to say. And we even saw that even though they were unlearned, they were taken note of because they spoke in a way that was like the greatest of the scholars. Yeah. So we saw and looked at a lot of those things. What I want to look on and focus on for the remainder here is if you go to verse 20, I want to get into 20 down through chapter 21 of Luke. Yeah, we won't get there far. Let's go to verse 27 now. Any other chance we do? 20 to 27.
You're going to start off?
I'll start it off, and then we can kind of read around the room. Verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near.
Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out. And let not them that are in the countries enter therein too.
For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled.
But woe unto
the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled.
There will be signs in sun, moon, and stars, and in the land anguish among the nations, and their bewilderment at the roaring of the sea and its billows.
Men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken.
And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory.
Okay, that's good. So let's look here at some of this. I want to just read one verse over again, because this translates it a little bit differently, and it's a big difference. And it's based off of the word that's translated, can somebody read verse 26 again?
And his heart's failing them for fear, and looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken.
Yeah, the word earth there. Okay? That word is the same one that Luke uses when he talks about all the world going to be taxed when Jesus is being born.
Yeah.
Okay? It literally has the idea of a local geographic region.
The word?
I'll mispronounce it. It's ortho... Jesus was born. The Roman Empire did.
Yeah, right.
Right? And this renders it here. Let me kind of read it the way it's rendered here. Men's hearts failing them for awe and for looking after those things which are coming on the empire, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Like, empire is the idea of a local geographic region. What's the region? The Roman Empire. Okay? And I think it's important to keep that in note. I think one of the things that is really, most translations do a bad job when it comes to the translation of the words that we look at as world or earth or land or soil. For instance, just in the Old Testament, there's the word Eretz, which is typically translated earth, but it really is better rendered land.
The land of Israel.
The land of Israel. It's used of the earth, but typically, you know, for instance, Genesis 1:1, it's that word that's used, and the idea is that it's talking about the globe, so to speak, but it literally means ground. It typically is translated earth. In the New Testament, you typically have aeon, which will be translated world in a lot of translations, which is just a terrible translation of that word. That really would be better rendered as eon, or aeonian will sometimes be translated world. But again, it would be better aeonian or age during, age abiding, something in that line. Then you have the word cosmos, which typically is translated world. You know, that's probably the best rendering out of all the words used. You have Gehe, which is typically translated as earth.
The root of the word geography.
Right. Gehe, but that would be similar to Eretz in Hebrew. It would really be better translated land. So those words are important. Then, how do you pronounce that again?
Okone?
Okone.
Oi.
Okay. I just can't get my tongue around that. But that really is a local geographic region. It's interesting, and this is a sidebar. While we're on this subject, maybe we'll spark a discussion at some point. It's interesting that that word is most used in the book of Revelation. It's used more in the book of Revelation than all the other books combined.
And so it has this sense of, like you said, empire.
Region.
Governmental structure in a region.
Right.
Versus cosmos, which would mean something more along the line of society.
Right.
With its norms and mores and all that.
Right.
The god of this world, for example.
You're in, it's cosmos or eon. So I think it's just important to keep that in note, though, because it really does play a part in how we understand it. Some translations, in fairness to them, I know Darby does a good job where he does try to make a distinction, and he consistently will translate the world as the habitable world, but that falls short. Because really, I think the Concordant uses the idea of the Greek-speaking world as opposed to the non-Greek-speaking world in reference to the word. That's actually more accurate, and
really?
It's getting more of a sense of where it is. But there is that distinction. It's a very limited area in scope.
But not very limited.
Well, very limited in the scheme of the entire planet,
But the Roman Empire was a massive portion of the inhabited Earth.
Well, it was a massive portion of Europe and
Europe and the Middle East.
Right.
Even stretching into all of North Africa.
Yeah. But again, it didn't get as far as even Greece had got. So, you know, in the scheme of things, it's smaller than the Grecian Empire. But it's a bigger area like that. So, having went through that discussion, let's kind of look at some of these verses now. In verse 20, Luke has here, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Now, if somebody wouldn't mind, maybe we could have one of the folks on the phone. If one of you individuals on the phones don't mind taking Matthew 24 and reading verse 15 for us.
I will.
Okay.
Matthew 24:15 says, whenever then you may be perceiving the abomination of desolation, which is declared through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him who is reading apprehend.
Okay. And then, could somebody else on the phone read Mark 13:14?
I will.
Okay.
Mark 13:14. Now, whenever you may be perceiving the abomination of desolation, declared by Daniel the prophet, standing where it must not, let the reader apprehend.
Okay, the interesting thing is both Matthew and Mark make a reference to Daniel's prophecy and the holy place. You know, the abomination of desolation in the holy place, which is in where? Where's the holy place?
The temple.
In the temple. Luke makes no mention of the abomination, and Luke makes no mention of the temple. Luke is concerned with the city. And again, Luke 21:20, But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation, the city of Jerusalem's desolation, has come near. Where Matthew and Mark tie that all back into Daniel, Luke is silent about the prophecy of Daniel. He doesn't even mention it. And I think it's a significant difference here where Matthew and Mark are looking at the temple and the events that are going to transpire inside the temple, and Luke is looking at the city of Jerusalem and the events that are going to transpire for the city. Now, we have to understand they're closely related, because if the city falls, then obviously the temple's falling at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, so by that extension, Luke sees the fall of the temple. But Luke is concerned with the destruction of Jerusalem itself. He's not per se going back to Daniel and tying it into what Daniel was talking about. He's tying it in with what's going to happen with Jerusalem and how Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Now, it's interesting. Back in Luke chapter 19, if you want to go there for a second. Luke 19. Okay, Jesus speaking, verse 41. And when he came into view of the city, this is Jerusalem, as he approached it, he broke into loud weeping. If you had only known today what could have brought you peace, but now it is hidden from your sight. The time will come for you when your enemies will throw ramparts around you and encompass you and shut you in on every side and raise you to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the era of your visitation. The whole idea he's getting at here is he's lamenting Jerusalem because he sees the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, it's important for us to know, when Daniel's abomination takes place, the city of Jerusalem isn't destroyed. It's not.
It's the temple.
The temple's there, and he's in the temple. Luke is talking about the destruction of the city. He's talking about something altogether different than what Matthew and Mark are focused on. Matthew and Mark are focused, again, at the signs for the end of this present eon. Luke is looking at the short-term fulfillment of when will the temple be destroyed, but in relation to the destruction of the temple is the destruction of the city. That's what Luke is focusing on. And this is one of the big differences. It's interesting because there's a lot of commentaries that are out there that will try to tell you that Luke is an extension of Mark. That he really got his account from Mark, and he's almost word for word what Mark is. But where they differ is significant. And they really are significant. This is one of those areas where they differ. Luke is focusing on the city. In chapter 19, as Jesus is entering into Jerusalem, he talks about a time coming when their enemies would encompass them or surround them, that they would build ramparts. Now, what ramparts are?
This is the odd thing, James, is a trench. Cast a trench.
Yeah.
How do you cast a trench? You can dig a trench or
yeah.
a boat.
Yeah.
You cast a rampart.
Yeah. It's not a trench, and a trench is not a good word there.
No.
Rampart is actually something that they would construct. And if anybody ever saw, I'm trying to think of some good movies that might depict
it. The movie Masada. With Peter O'Toole in it.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
They spent months and even years building a causeway that Alexander the Great did that, but a ramp to get up to Masada. They didn't think it was possible. They had all these hundreds of feet to ascend.
Right.
But they kept bringing in dirt from everywhere. And I remember
17
is going to go all the way through towards the end of the to the end of the chapter, verse 37. But he's getting into that idea of that judgment, where he's looking at the events that would transpire that would culminate in the second unveiling of the Son of Man. You know, in Luke 21, that's not what he's doing. He's looking here at a specific day's of vengeance. Now, he doesn't say the day of vengeance. He uses the plural days of vengeance. Now, it's interesting, the day of vengeance, oftentimes in Scripture, is a reference to the day of the Lord, or the day of Yahweh. But the days of vengeance is more than one day. And what he's talking about is the city of Jerusalem itself being under siege. It's the days of Roman vengeance against Judah's rebellion against Roman authority. Because again, they started a rebellion in 68 AD. They set up their own government, and they self-governed themselves for 2 years before Titus had his army in place to begin the siege. So they had 2 years of self-rule there, from 68 AD to 70 AD. The siege really began in like the spring of AD 69. And they were literally starved out for about a year and a half. And really, that's what happened. They were starved out. And then the Roman armies came in, and they just totally took the city apart brick by brick, is what they did. You know, and then they took the wealth of the city back to Rome. And later on, Titus would become emperor. In large part, due to the great following he won from this siege. You know, so you have this going on, and then Masada would fall a number of years later. It's where the government of Israel and some few holdouts would go, and they actually would commit mass suicide rather than yield to Rome, which is how that ended. They had no chance. They were doomed. And everything that Luke was talking about here came to pass. Now, he talks about these are days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. Now, the question then comes in, what is written? And I think it's, again, a reference going back to some of the passages that talk about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem itself. And again, you're going to see those references scattered throughout the evangel accounts. You know, Matthew, Matthew right around 9 through 12, 13, you have references of the city being under siege. You have references to all of the gospel accounts make a reference to the fig tree in the days of the Gentiles trotting it underfoot, and so on. So you have these references. Now he says here that there would be great distress in verse 23. There will be great distress on the land and wrath against this people, the end part of the verse. Again, the word here is gehe, on this land. Some translations will render it on the earth. You know, let me read 23, just so everybody can follow. Luke 21:23. Woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing their babies in those days. For there will be great distress on the land, and wrath against this people. Now the word gehe, again, I think everywhere that word reads in the New Testament, it should be translated as land. But he gets into this idea that there's going to be great distress on the land and wrath against these people. He talks about those who are nursing their babies in those days. The days he's referencing in context is the days of vengeance. Right? The days of vengeance being the destruction of Jerusalem. And what he's getting at here is that there's going to be great distress and wrath against this people. Now, again, it's a short-term fulfillment of a long-term event. Luke is giving you how the events played out in 70 AD before 70 AD occurs. Matthew and Mark are going to give you the way it plays itself out in the day of Yahweh, way out into the future, you know, from the vantage point of this prophecy. And again, I think we have to keep that in mind, because again, this is one of the passages that your preterists will really go to try to hit home why they believe that the Olivet Discourse already took place and has already transpired. They have it partially correct. Luke's answer did take place. Matthew and Mark has not occurred yet. And you know, they see Luke very clearly, and they just assume, because it's Jesus talking and it's the same event being recorded in scriptures, they just assume, like a lot of people do, that all the gospel events are recording the same things anyways. And that's a mistaken notion to have. Because the gospel accounts, yes, they record the same events, but they are recording it with a different goal and a different purpose. And sometimes events have more than one way on how it transpires. And what you're seeing is one of those events that has different ways on how it plays out. Matthew and Mark are looking at one specific question, the end of the eon. Luke is looking at the destruction of the temple. So they're not even looking at the same
Luke's
event.
Looking at the destruction of the city.
Right.
Which includes the temple.
Which includes the temple
so
being
Luke,
destroyed.
Luke's account and what actually did transpire in 70 AD is actually a type of what the tribulation is going to be according to the events of Matthew and Mark.
That's correct. And in case somebody on the phone didn't hear it, what John brought up is that Luke is a type of what's going to transpire in Matthew and Mark. And that's correct. Luke is the type.
The forerunner.
It's the forerunner. And you know, except it'll be much worse by the time you get to Matthew and Mark.
That'll be a larger scale.
It'll be a larger scale. You know, so I think it's important to keep that. Now, verse 24. They will fall by the sword or be carried off into slavery among all the Gentiles. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles till the eras of the Gentiles have expired. Now, it's interesting. He's getting into this idea. They'll fall by the sword. That's literally, you're going to have a lot of people die, or be carried off into slavery among all the Gentiles. And again, this has already taken place a number of times by the time Luke writes. In reference to Judah was carried away into exile by Nebuchadnezzar. But if you're including the 10 northern tribes in with that, they were carried away into exile by Assyria. So you have multiple, if you want to look at it this way, multiple dispersions. This is a third one that's being referenced.
Yeah.
If you really wanted to be technical about it, you know, because Assyria would be one, Babylon a second, and then you have this one here, Rome, the Roman dispersion. That's why, for instance,
and yet another one, the ultimate.
The ultimate. have, you can have writers in the epistles here writing to Jewish believers in Rome. Why? Because they were carried away. When John is recording events in the book of Revelation, for instance, I think, again, Revelation is one of those books where it's a tough book because it reads symbolically, but I believe some of what John is writing about is what Luke is talking about, and I think some of what John is talking about is what Matthew and Mark are talking about. That's why he says in Revelation that he's seeing a vision of things that were, things that are, and things that shall be. He's saw some things that took place in the past from the vantage point of when he wrote the book of Revelation. He saw some things that were transpiring at that time. And again, it's very possible that this was already beginning at the time that John wrote Revelation. And then some things that will be out into the future. So I think you have to really just pay attention to the words that are used to see where it's lining up. And that's where it becomes really critical to pay attention to those words like Jerusalem or the holy place, and paying attention to those things. So he's saying, though, that Israel would remain in this condition of being trampled underfoot until the eras of the Gentiles have expired. Now, the word till implies that there will be a time again when Israel or Judah, but I'm going to say Israel collectively, will have a central role in what it is that God's doing. It implies that will take place at some point in the future. We could say, absolutely, that Israel is still not in the land because they are still La'omai. Even though there's Jews in that area of the world, the vast majority of Jews do not live in that part of the world. They live in fact, there's more Jews that live in New York City than live in Israel. So there's more Jews that live in Russia than live in Israel. So, they're still dispersed. The temple still is not standing. And in fact, you could argue if the temple's not standing, then Judaism, as it's laid out in the scriptures, doesn't exist. They need it. They need something. They don't even have a tabernacle. Right? I mean, you could get by without a temple if maybe you went back to the tabernacle sort of an idea, but they don't even have that. So their religion really, with the events that Luke is talking about here, is forever changed. It's not the same anymore. It's a religion that really just is a dead religion.
Gentiles don't really end until the return of Christ.
Till the unveiling of Christ, yep. At the second advent.
And based on Daniel's prophecy. Because Luke is actually talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and even here he's saying that Jerusalem will be trodden under.
Right.
Temple could be part of the reconstruction prior to the Messiah's return.
Right. In fact, there's more Muslims that live in the city of Jerusalem than Jews.
Right.
Today.
More Arabs.
Yeah, more Arabs. So, and in fact, I think it was up until the Six Days War where Jerusalem was really totally under control of the Arabs. So, it wasn't until that war when Israel actually physically took control of that in modern times. So you have that idea. That might be a a good place to stop. But I think the main point I really wanted to get across and why I took this is it's just important to realize that sometimes when there's the discrepancies in these gospel accounts, the discrepancy is on purpose because they aren't talking about the same thing. It reads like they are, you know, because you have Jesus talking to his disciples and they're having this discussion about how gorgeous the temple is, and he talks about the destruction of the temple. So in that sense, it all reads very similar, but they're not talking about the same thing.
Until you hit the fine print.
And I think it's important when we study Scripture to really look at those little minute details. You know, Ted did a study at the conference up in Brockport last year, or 2 years ago. And he brought in the Great White Throne Judgment, the use of the words biblion and biblios. And most translations just translate the books, or books. But really, one means the little book, and the other one means the large book, or large scroll. And it really is a very big distinction when you understand it that way. Because the small books were open, the judgment's being passed, and then all of a sudden it's a large book. How did it go from being small to large, unless more names were added into it? Which is where I think it takes place there. You have people at the Great White Throne Judgment who come into the relationship with Christ because they see him, just like Paul did in 1 Timothy chapter 1. So those little words can make a huge difference in how you understand something. And I think, you know, when you start looking at the little differences that Luke has, he really is talking about something different that's taking place and transpiring. It reads similar.
Oh, very similar. Yeah.
It does. But, you know, in fact, I
would think it's the same thing.
You would. You would. And most people do. And, again,
well, it really starts to read similar after it looks like a new paragraph on verse 25.
Right. And what I would submit is that I believe at that point, Luke is there beginning to talk about the signs, the second part of the question. That's right. And he's changing focus. His end discussion is verse 24, where he ends it, Jerusalem being destroyed and trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. Then he goes to talking about what the signs of the times for the end of the eon is, and he begins to lay that out. But that's why I figured it was a good breaking point, because I didn't want to get into all of that. Yeah. So, any questions?
Bill, how does the preterist deal with that switch between verse 23? In verse 24, where you, like you just pointed out, this is a switch in focus to the future. So if the preterists say that, you know, all this stuff has been fulfilled, how do they explain or deal with, especially verse 24, where it reads that Jerusalem should be trodden on by the nations until the heirs of the nations be fulfilled? Well, that hasn't happened yet.
Right. The way, and I can't speak for every preterist, the way I understand their thinking is they would say verse 27 is a reference to the second advent of Christ, which we would agree with that. It is a reference to the second advent of Christ. The difference is that their take on it is that it took place already in 70 AD. He didn't come in person. They don't understand him coming in person. They take the passage out of Matthew chapter 16 where it says the Son shall come as the Father in the glory of the Father, right? The Son shall be coming in clouds in the glory of the Father. They take that passage to say that the Father came in his Shekinah glory in Exodus 40. And that's how the sun returns. It's not a physical return, it's a spiritual return. And that's how they try to get away. They're very literal in looking at everything being physical until you get to that second advent, in which case he's returning as the Father came in glory. The Father came in glory in Exodus 40, and Jesus is coming in that manner in their mind. He did that in 70 AD, in their thinking. And there are preterists who actually would even go so far as to say we are already into the new heaven and new earth.
Wow.
Because they understand...
What are all these ceremonies?
Again, here's their argument. Here's their argument, though. Hold on, their argument makes some sense. We're dismissing it because we look at the word earth and we say, okay, the earth, the whole globe. The word is gehe in Greek, meaning the land. And all they would say is that it never had a reference to the entire globe. That it's a reference to the land of Israel only. And
it would still boggle the mind to think that God would have given all this scripture, Old Testament, New Testament, describing all these events that happened with his dearly beloved son, and yet not leave a record of such an occurrence after 70 AD, that he really did return in all this magnificence and glory.
Well, I agree with you. Now, of course, they go back to, I'm just joking here, being a little flippant, but there is another testament, you know. It's called the Book of Mormon is the further revelation of, just joking, guys. Don't take me serious on that. But I do agree with you. I think that's one of the weak points of their whole argument. I think it breaks down when you start looking at the end time chronology events and, you know, to really argue that, you know, the second advent took place in 70 AD and the rapture occurred in 70 AD, to me seems kind of a lunacy sort of an idea. But, you know, I think it's just somebody that saw something and tried to harmonize it because, again, they made the mistaken notion that Luke is saying the same thing that Matthew and Mark are saying, and they're trying to harmonize it so that it is all saying the same thing. And you know, and that's what happens, I think, when you get careless, you create other issues for yourself.
Forcing a misunderstanding into the verses.
Right, right. So, does what I said tonight make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Bill, there's a couple of thoughts I have, too. In Luke 21:37,
right.
It says, now during the days he was in the sanctuary teaching, yet during the nights coming out, he camped out in the mount called Olivet, and right. The entire people came early to him in the sanctuary to hear him. What you were focusing on tonight, this is when he was in the sanctuary, correct?
No, it actually would have been when he was on the mount.
Yeah,
with the disciples privately.
Does it say privately in Luke 21, though?
In Luke 21? If you go back to Luke 21, let me come back earlier. It doesn't say that, no.
But in Matthew 24:3, it does mention privately, and that's when he was on. And that's when he was on the mount.
That's correct. That's a good way to look at it because, again, if you really want to be technical, in Luke 21, You know, he's just seen the poor widow giving money. And then
in Matthew 24:1, it says, "In coming out, Jesus went from the sanctuary."
Right.
"And his disciples approached to exhibit to him the buildings of the sanctuary, yet he answered and said to them, 'Are you not observing all these?'" And then verse 3, "Now it is sitting on the Mount of Olives."
Right.
"The disciples came to him privately." So it seems like Matthew's making a distinction between earlier.
Right.
As to when he's now on the mountain. And when he's on the mountain, it seems like he's speaking of the future events of the being fulfilled here.
Right.
And in Luke 21, it's more of the, what's, like you said, going to be the short term. It's already occurred.
Right. Well, it's interesting, too, because when you look at verse 5 in Luke 21, now, well, some people were talking about the temple. So we don't know who those people are, but they're probably people that are...
Well, verse 45 of the previous chapter, 20, 45. "Then in the audience of all the people, he said unto his disciples, beware of the scribes, the son of the water,
right,
and all that." And that's a continued, chapter 21 is a continued.
It just flows in, yeah.
Right.
So that would give credence to what you're saying there, Ted.
The other thing I was thinking of is in Luke 21:23,
right,
where the concordance says the last part of verse 23, "in indignation on this people."
Right.
I think yours said the wrath.
There will be great distress on the land and wrath.
Yep. Yeah, wrath on the people. That may tie in with 1 Thessalonians 2:16, where the concordance says, "Yet the indignation outstrips to them to a consummation."
Right.
And I think in Thessalonians, Paul is referring to a prior event. Well, I'm sorry, it wouldn't be a prior event. Well,
it would be a future event from the vantage point of when Paul's writing.
Right, right. But it'd be something that was going on, was in a process of going on when he's writing, I guess I should say.
Right.
When he's in Thessalonians.
Well, it's interesting, too, because he already talks about the mystery of iniquity doth already work, or does already work, or is at work. And again, whatever it is that he's talking about in 2 Thessalonians there has already begun to have a work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah, very good. Very good thoughts, Bill.
Very good. So, for everybody, is Thursday good for next week?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Right.
Very good. So, why don't we close in a word of prayer while we have everybody.